Welcome back.
Thank you.
We're back.
Thank you.
We're doing once a month episodes now.
Yeah.
But that's temporary because we're busy right now.
It's because we don't like doing this.
Well, Camille doesn't. I forgot what I was going to say. Dune. Dune 2.
Here's all I have to say about it.
That's the soundtrack by Hans Zimmer.
Oh.
What do you actually have to say about Dune 2? That's like the two things, the three things that have been on my mind lately. Is like Dune,
Lethal Company.
World, and Lethal Company.
Yep. Nothing's on my mind. Ever.
Yeah. Welcome to Gallery. We got some good topics for you today.
You don't know my topic.
And we also don't have our nice cameras anymore. Because we...
Keep that to yourself.
What are you talking about today?
I'm talking about how to calm your anxiety journal.
By Lisa...
Lisa Kindred.
Are you actually talking about that?
No.
What are you talking about?
This is my shield so you don't see my paper.
Fun fact, I wrote down all of my notes in a nice, neat Amazon Basics yellow notepad. That technically was Camille's, so I guess this is my fault. But she was organizing her desk like she does once a year, and she ripped my notes out and threw them in the garbage. So there's like a grease stain right here, and they're all crumpled a little bit, but I got them.
Wouldn't you do the same?
I guess it was my fault since...
I was like, oh, what is this crap?
What is this rip? Throw it in the trash.
I didn't even read it. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
So I'll read it now.
What's the medium? What's your category this episode?
I'm doing a game.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Are you serious?
Mm-hmm. That's why I'm hiding it from you.
Because I know it.
Yeah, you sniff it out.
Really good. Yeah. Yeah. Just like I sniff out all the treats and sweets in our house.
That's true.
I do be stealing sweets from the cupboard.
I literally will come home. Okay.
Can you shut up? You're talking about a game.
Mm-hmm.
What game? Give me a hint, because I bet I can
guess.
Wait,
am I going first?
Yeah, you always go first.
Okay. Yeah.
We also switched places this time.
Yeah.
Because the lighting is better on that side, and we all deserve to see Camille's beauty in
Expose
that
light. Expose me, for real, you know?
Give me a hint as to what you're talking about.
Okay. Wait, actually first, I want you to tell me what makes a good video game.
What makes a good video game?
Yeah.
Obviously, that's subjective. But...
Try to be objective.
I've always thought if a game is fun, then it's good. Mm. Now, that's where it gets tricky because, you know, you think of games like... let's see. Like... I don't know. Like some Pokemon games are not that good, but they're fun. Like Scarlet and Violet, I wouldn't call those like objectively good games, but you and I bought them both and we had fun with them.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's tons of games that I like and I play that generally are not considered good, but they're fun.
So what's like this objective standard that people consider good for games?
Well, it's different for everybody. Sometimes if the game is AAA or has good graphics, then that automatically means it's good no matter what. Like, if a game has good graphics, then it's infallible. Mm. Honestly. That's kind of how the video game industry works. I guarantee that if, like, games like Red Dead Redemption 2 or even, like, The Last of Us Part 2 or even the first Last of Us, if their graphics were not as good as they were, people would criticize the gameplay a lot more. Mm. But that's just my opinion, and I don't want to go off on a tangent. But that's one thing is, like, graphics are big. If it's AAA, that's big. If it's the sequel to a really good game, I mean, half of the reason why Tears of the Kingdom is a masterpiece is just because Breath of the Wild was a masterpiece. So, and then a lot of it comes down to like multiplayer. Lethal Company is rough around the edges, but it's so good because of the experiences that it has. And some games were masterpieces back then and considered like not as good now, like the original Metroid. I could go off, but that's kind of what I have to say. I know I give you a lot there, but...
That was perfect. So, like you said, there's a million different things to consider, especially in the world of video games. But consider this. Pop Tropica.
Are you talking about Pop Tropica?
Yeah.
Pop Tropica is awesome.
Why? Why do you think it's awesome?
Pop Tropica. Okay, I'm going to say this. Pop Tropica is awesome because it was nostalgic for me. Mm-hmm. And I would play it with my sisters all the time. And I would log on and I'd create a new profile because my web browser was old and wouldn't save anything. And we would just do all the islands for hours. And we would look up like stuff on like online and walkthroughs on how to get past certain islands. Do you want to explain what Pop Tropica is?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So it is an online role-playing game developed by Pearson Education's Family Education Network. It's targeted towards children aged 6 to 15.
It was also created by Jeff Kinney,
the creator of Diary of a Wimpy Kid.
The author of Diary of a Kid.
I learned that, and I think I had like a transcendent moment where I was like, is this the same guy?
Yeah.
Yeah. So he created Diary of a Wimpy Kid. And he's loved by the people.
We love Jeff Kinney.
We love Jeff Kinney because he made our childhoods happy. But this game, so it's really basically just you log on, you can create a little character, like it's a goofy looking character because it's just circles.
They look like frogs.
Yeah, they kind of do. And you can fly your blimp to little islands, and each island is themed after something. Like, some of them were even themed after the Diary of a Wimpy Kid books, and or, like, Big Nate and stuff. Some of them are themed after, like, ancient Greece or, like...
There's, like, a superhero island.
The superhero island. There's a spy island.
There's a spy island. There's, like, yeah.
And the goal is for the kids to kind of find the problem and help fix the problem.
Yeah.
So it's a problem-solving game.
It's I would say it's, like, a puzzle game.
Yeah.
Most of it is, like, puzzle-solving.
Yep. In 2011, it was listed on Time Magazine's list of 50 websites that make the web great, where it was described as an inventive megabyte for kids with a wholesome and slightly educational bent. In 2012, the game had over 75 million registered users, and it has been released on Nintendo DS, iOS, and Android.
Nice.
So, in figuring out like what to say about this topic, because I was thinking about it lately. There's been a lot of buzz about it because Pop Tropica has switched to be hosted on Cool Math Games.
Wasn't it going to shut down?
It was going to shut down.
And then Cool Math saved it or something?
And so it's now hosted on Cool Math Games, what is that called?
Exclusively. It's a Cool Math Games exclusive, so take that, Sony. Sorry.
So I've been thinking about that a lot and about this, about the role that it played in my childhood too. Because the reason why I liked it is because it's super nostalgic for me.
Yeah.
But I wondered kind of what I would think going back to the game as an adult, as someone who has like studied media and plays a lot of AAA games and stuff.
Yeah.
And it was so interesting because it's still really fun. And and this is my experience. Like, I went on the web and I looked at all these articles, and there was a lot of people who were like, oh, I did the same thing. Like, I went back to Pop Tropica, and it's the worst because they took out all my favorite islands.
They've changed it a lot. Mm,
it's been changed a lot. You can't immediately customize your character.
Yep.
And it's very different.
It's really interesting to see how modern gaming has influenced Pop Tropica,
mm-hmm.
and how there's like...
There's a subscription base.
There's a subscription. And stuff. There's some live service elements in here. Ooh, live service
games. Yeah, yeah.
By the way, I don't like live service games, but...
But so a lot of people had a lot of issue with that, and they said this was fun when I was 10, but not anymore and stuff.
Dang.
But when I went back and played it, I had a ton of fun, and I played through two islands.
Which ones?
I played through 24 Karat Island.
That's like the beginner one.
And the Greek one.
That's the best one. Shaylin, Emma, if you're listening, you know mythology is the best one. Anyway, sorry, those are my sisters.
But some islands that I wanted to talk about were the Cryptids Island.
That one's really good.
Time too. Tangled, the Superheroes, Shark Tooth Island.
Superhero one is my favorite.
Spy Island and 24 Karat Island. I spent so much time on these in my childhood, and I just like, I kind of wanted to pose this question to you. Is the nostalgia factor for games...
Ooh.
Something that you can really rate games on.
Wow, this is a big discussion in gaming discourse. especially with like the Nintendo 64 era of games, because with the NES and the Super Nintendo and the Sega Genesis, that era of games, they had really tweaked and perfected that 2D sprite. It was difficult to find clunky games back then. The clunkiest game is like Kid Icarus and Metroid, which still play great. But the Nintendo 64 was new hardware, and it was really clunky. And so, honestly, a lot of games haven't aged the best. I'll be the first to say that as much of a landmark and as legendary as I think Ocarina of Time is, there are parts that haven't aged well. But people often rate games based off of the experience that they've had with them. And so when people think of, oh, is the Ocarina of Time good? They think back on the memories they've had, and they think back on, you know, what the moments in the game that shocked them the most. They don't really think about, well, the slingshot controls in the minigame were a little janky. No, they don't. So to answer your question, I think it can be something to consider. I think that if we're talking about, you know, your favorite game, then obviously nostalgia can totally play a part in that. But I think what you're trying to get at is more the objectivity of it. And that's hard to say. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Well, I was thinking about this a lot in preparation.
Yeah.
And I realized that the thing that's swaying me is that Poptropica was made for kids.
Okay.
And so I feel that the nostalgia factor is a completely, like, a fully appropriate, like, way to talk about this game.
Mm, because the kid-like feelings that you feel now were the intentional feelings that Poptropica was trying to bring out.
And they're feelings that kids can still get from this game.
Mm.
Even if it has changed a little bit.
Okay.
It is still the educational and the fun game that it is.
Wow, that's a really good point.
I know. And so I was looking up like why this was good for kids, like why some games can be more good for kids and stuff. And I realized that how you move around in Poptropica, there's no controllers, there's no WASD, there's just a point and click mouse.
Yep.
And if you hold the mouse, you go. And it's in the arrow of wherever your mouse is pointing.
It's so easy.
It's extremely easy. And you don't even have to talk to NPCs necessarily. They just kind of talk to you. You're thrown into things. The language is very simple.
Yep. There's not a death system. There's, mm-mm. You know, if you fail something. I think there's very few islands where you actually, like, die. But when you do, you just kind of sit down and then you go back to the beginning of the level.
Mm-hmm. I was at the mythology island and I drowned.
Which island?
The mythology island. And I drowned. I was in Poseidon's castle and I drowned. And I just went back to the beginning of the level. No fault, you know.
Yeah.
It's very, very kid friendly. And I was looking up. There is a blogger from 2018, Leona Henryson, that wrote an article on why Poptropica is so good for kids. And she had 5 points. She said, it's super entertaining. There's so many different games and islands and character creations. There are cool puzzles. It's something that can entertain both her and her kid at the same time.
Yeah.
Which not a lot of games give you the option to do.
Totally.
Like if you were to go, you know, with your kid and your kid really wants to play Fortnite, there's only so much that like a parent who doesn't know anything about gaming can do.
True.
But this kind of game being easy for kids means it's also easy for like technology, anti-technology adults to pick up as well.
Yeah. And I also think that, I kind of lost my train of thought. What was I going to say? It'll come to me. I think that this is a game that like, I would feel comfortable putting my kids on, and because I feel like it's kid friendly enough to make me okay with them playing it, like no questions asked. But I think it's in-depth enough and well-designed enough to not be like Cocomelon, like just like
garbage.
Dopamine, like farming garbage.
Yeah, yeah. Because there's still like educational like things to it and stuff. The only reason why I know what a chupacabra is because of the cryptids island.
I kid you not, I'm the same way.
Exactly.
It taught me
a
ton.
It haunted me for months.
Yeah. And
it
like,
really did.
It got me into like other browser games. I mean, I think what I'm most learning from what you're saying is that like when done right, I mean, we live in a day and age that when done right, games can be incredibly healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And they can funnel you into education and problem solving skills and technology skills. Mm-hmm. And I think that Jeff Kinney artistically found a really great balance between that.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So she continues in her blog post. The second item is it helps kids have computer literacy.
So yeah, they're which able is to, super important.
Mm-hmm, they're able to type in the word Poptropica, click the link. They're able to point around the mouse and stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's something that, I mean, in this day and age, we kind of take for granted that you need to learn how to use a computer. And that's a good way to do it.
And a lot of that, I mean, I wouldn't say it's educational in the sense that, like, it's having you do math problems or having you, like, do history. I think it's educational in the way that it helps kids use their motor skills really well, because you don't progress in the game by, like learning combat controls or, like, learning to, like, how many iframes, like, you know. There's not super intricate gameplay systems that move the game forward, but there is, like, visual cues and key and lock systems and reading. There's mm-hmm. tons mm-hmm. of reading. And so when kids play, they're learning to do these things in a fun way that they're going to be doing their whole life.
Exactly.
Anyway, I feel like I keep interrupting you.
No, that's great. Because that's the next point, is that it's fun to do together as a parent-child because some puzzles require reading comprehension. And, like, think of the Time Tangled Island, and we've got Da Vinci, and we've got, like, the climbers from Mount Everest, and all of these, like, famous people and stuff, and you're helping get them the things that they need. And a child's little brain can be like, oh, I know who this goes to. We can go to them and bring it to them and stuff. And that's such a cool, like, rewarding feeling for a kid to get and a parent to help with.
Yeah, totally.
Number four, it's safe.
Super safe.
There's not, like, chats that you can
yep.
put your own language in. You're not interacting with strangers in an unhealthy way. I feel like parents can just drop their kid on this game and leave him alone and not worry,
yep.
which is also taken for granted today. And she said the last one is that it's free.
It's 100%
it's free to use. And maybe it's not what it was in its former glory. And I don't think it ever will be.
Things change.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Adobe Flash is gone. But it really was a special time. And it was fun for me as a kid to, like, finish whatever homework assignment I had and be one of the first kids to, like, go over and play Poptropica on the computers in class.
Totally.
And so I kind of want to close with what I wrote. I said one reason for the difference in impact may be that social media is primarily about marketing or comparing oneself to others, while gaming is generally about socializing with friends, solving a puzzle, or engaging in competition.
Super true.
And so I was just thinking, like, it's so cool to see what gaming can do for kids, especially in a digital environment
mm-hmm.
where they can be bombarded with social media nonstop from, like, the moment they open their eyes, but there's still good ways to participate online.
Yeah. It's tough because Bo Burnham has said, I love Bo Burnham, and he said that corporations and, like, social media companies are trying to colonize your time. They want every second of your time. And that's really dangerous. But we also live in a world where technology is just everywhere and it's everything. And so you really have to find that balance of, like, correct technology usage that isn't, you know, like, taking up so much of your time and mental energy in an unhealthy way.
Mm-hmm.
And gosh, Poptropica kills it at striking that balance. I know we kind of already said that, but
totally. And so that's kind of what I had to say. So it was an interesting exercise for me to think about Poptropica as an art form. And something that can sit next to, like, God of War or, you know, stuff like that. And it's very, very awesome.
Totally. What do you see, buddy? Our dog's looking out the window right now. Beautifully said.
I know.
Poptropica. Wow. A game I forget about a lot, but it is so important.
Go back and play it.
Go back and play it. It's like we said, it's free and fun. And
24 Karat Island took me like 15 minutes.
That's true. It is mad easy.
Yeah.
Did you ever play Astro Knights Island?
Uh-uh.
That one's so tough. That one's like, that one, back in the golden age of Pop Tropica, that one was so tough. It was like the hardest one ever.
Well, I would only play on Superhero Island because you could fly and
and you could like make your own superhero and you could go to that like comic book store.
And like my family was obsessed with the Spy Island so much so that like every time we'd go to the dollar store, we'd be like, "Mom, get a spy gear, please."
Yeah, what was it with like spy culture as like a kid?
Spy kids, man.
Spy kids and like spy gadgets at the freaking Scholastic Book Fair. Every kid wanted to be a spy. Yeah, right, dude.
They'd be like invisible ink. Special glasses. Like, night vision goggles.
A journal that has a lock on it.
Yeah,
like for my log notes or whatever.
I'm glad that we all had the same childhood at the book fair. All
right, what is this, the History Channel? What is this? 60 Minutes with freaking Joe Biden? All right, sorry.
I challenge you to get a personality that isn't a YouTuber.
Frick you. Frick you. Okay, I feel like I say this every episode, but I always love the completely different topics that we choose.
What's yours?
I am talking about...
Anti-Pop Tropica.
I'm talking about evil Pop Tropica. What's evil Pop Tropica? Thanks. Okay.
Love that game.
I don't know if I want you to try. I don't know if you'd be able to guess mine, but I'm talking about visual art. Mm. And this is something, I'm in an art history class right now, and this is something that really stuck out to me.
It's going to be that ugly painting in the winter.
I am talking about this painting.
Oh.
This is called Soap Bubbles. And it's by a artist.
What's that little guy doing?
I know, right? It's by a painter named Jean-Simeon Chardon. And he is a Rococo painter.
I was just about to say, this is a Rococo.
This is a Rococo. So this is like, I think like later Rococo. So let me give you like a brief timeline of like how this painting came to be. So, you know, because of disasters in Europe, a lot of literature, a lot of like the printing press, a lot of art goes to Italy and... the Renaissance starts, and there's this interest in portraying new ideas with, like, old ways. Like, contemporary things with the way that the old masters did them. There's a lot of Greek and Roman stuff. There's a lot of, you know, of that same imagery. But people are showing what they're passionate about the best way they know how, okay? And then after the Renaissance happens... The church kind of raises in popularity. They're funding like all of the art, and there's a lot of wars that go on. The aristocracy rises, and along with the aristocracy rising, I kind of skipped over Baroque art, but basically you need to know that eventually, you know, during the Renaissance, and the Reformation, there's kind of this area where people are like, oh, no art. It's against religion. It's against what we believe. And then people clap back with like, well, we're just going to make even more art. It eventually evolves into the aristocracy being the main patrons of art. And that means that art starts to shift from religious iconography to show like what the aristocracy does. So there's a lot of art that emerges.
Well, in bubbles.
Well, hold on. There's a lot of art that emerges that's like, you've seen The Girl on the Swing, right?
Mm-hmm.
That is like the Rococo painting. So this is the era I'm talking about, the Rococo. Art has gone from, you know, classical showings of like the apostles and Jesus to flirtatious frivolity that the higher-ups show. And eventually, you know, this starts to become a big problem. You know, the French Revolution happens, and then that gets really bad. And then we start to get, like, the Enlightenment art, and then it starts to move into Romanticism and Realism. But Rococo was this time period where people kind of really started to be like, what if we didn't paint religion? And they started to... And the reason for that change of mindset is the main patrons of art started to be kings and queens and rich people rather than religious leaders. And so it's interesting to see the church kind of moving away from like cultural stuff, and there was still religious art. But anyway, the point that I'm trying to make, Rococo art was chill and kind of embodied like a lack of humility. Like, oh, look how much stuff we have. Look how rich we are. Which is interesting because in the later years of the Rococo, I think there was a point in the Rococo where artists like Vermeer were starting to, I think it's Vermeer, were starting to show like more everyday life, kind of not quite realism. It was still embellished to a degree, but they were really interested in showing the nobility of the workforce.
Oh no, not peasants.
And they started to explore maybe a great way to worship God is to just work hard in your own sphere. And so with like Vermeer's paintings, you see a lot of women like just working in their houses and like sewing things and talking with people. And so there's this period of Rococo art where there's kind of this not like frivolity, but more like restraint and, you know, serenity and like the importance of like everyday life, like putting your shoulders to the wheel and stuff. So now that's the History Channel. But anyway, the reason that I bring up all of this is because you have these big frivolous paintings, and then you have this period where there's this painting, which is called Soap Bubbles.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been thinking about this painting a lot lately. And so for our audio listeners, you can look at the episode art, but it's literally just a boy. He definitely looks well off. He does not look like a peasant. He's sitting in a window and he's blowing a big bubble.
With a
straw.
Straw.
Yeah. And this was an interesting picture to see after so much, you know, sandwiched right between like neoclassicism, where they're showing like the death of Marat and like all these really big paintings in like the period beforehand where there's all this religious stuff. And there's this little pocket of time where they're just kind of showing people chilling. And I really like that.
That's so interesting. I feel like it's so fun because I always forget how much of a luxury it really was to have and own art.
Yeah.
And even to paint art.
Yeah.
If it wasn't your trade or something.
Yeah.
And it really is fun because truly most of history was art is being used for religious purposes. It's being used to remember the dead. It's being used as like serious architecture and stuff. It's always been used for a purpose.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that humanity finally figured out that one of the purposes to life is hanging out.
I'm glad you said that because that's kind of the point that I'm trying to make. You know, as much as the aristocracy was freaking up France and stuff and, you know, being pretty frivolous and showing their artwork, I'm glad you said that because painting really was different back then. It was a trade. It was like calling a plumber or calling a, you know, construction person to build a house for you. If you wanted to show that something was important, you painted it, you know?
And so this is important.
Exactly.
In a way. That's really cool.
For some reason, Chardin is saying this moment right here where the bubble is just big enough right before it pops, this is important. And it's not like it's a really shoddy painting. It's not like he did it in 5 seconds. It's a realized, detailed, beautiful piece of artwork. And so you even have a lot of iconography in there. I mean, the brevity of life shown with the bubble. I mean, it's about to pop.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of this reinforced message that, hey, life is fleeting. Enjoy it while you're here right now. And so I think I don't have much to say other than that, like, I really love the attitude of this painting in what you said. Some, you know, Chardin thought this moment, this little moment of these two young boys wanting to blow bubbles was important enough to say, you know, the way those Renaissance guys showed their, you know, what they believed, I'm going to do it in the same way.
So cool.
And I think that's so beautiful. So I kind of want to ask you, like, what's your like painting today? How do you show what's important to you?
Well, that's a good question. Like what? Like medium?
Not necessarily medium, but like back then, painting was a huge way to show what was important to people. And now we have a lot of different ways.
Oh, I take pictures.
Take pictures?
I take pictures of what's important to me.
Photography.
Uh-huh.
Nice.
Well, I think it's so interesting to think about the preservation of what's important to you, especially in today. And especially, I'm thinking like it was a luxury to have these kinds of paintings back then. And even now, when art is so much more commonplace, I still think it's sort of a luxury to be able to be painting what you want, kind of thing.
And I think it's kind of a luxury to, in this day and age, I think it's kind of a luxury to have things that are lasting.
Yeah.
You know, everything in this world is so fleeting. I mean, everything in this world is the soap bubble that's painted here. It's just there for a second and then it's gone and it's just there. But like today, I think it's so valuable to have our modern day quote unquote Rococo paintings, which were so important that like people wanted them to stick around forever. They wanted to cement this image in oils on a canvas. And so I think today we have those things like writing and taking pictures and like, you know, there's just so many things that like, you said it better than I did, is that like, it's a luxury to have things that last.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a luxury to paint the simplicities of life. Yeah. And this, I mean, finding a modern day equivalent to some like aristocrat blowing a bubble.
Yeah.
I, for some reason, I thought of Barbie.
And interesting. Her, the movie?
Yeah, the movie. And her talking to that old lady at the bus stop.
Yeah.
Which is like my favorite scene in the whole movie. Yeah. And she basically just tells this random old lady that she's beautiful. And the old lady says, "I know." And it's just a very simple scene. And I heard that it was something that the producers wanted her to cut. But she kept it in. And for some reason, I feel like it's so similar to this almost. It's,
I know.
This little luxury of just simplicity, of being at peace, of being focused on what you're doing. And it's something that's not life changing, but those are the most important moments.
Yeah. You think of everything going on right now with the aristocracy and the French Revolution coming to fruition. And there's just these two boys blowing soap bubbles. And that's so important to them right now. And that was so important to this painter.
Cool.
And I think that's so beautiful.
It is really beautiful.
So like, I don't know, live in the moment. Like, blow what's soap important bubbles. To you? Blow soap bubbles, man. Like,
talk to old ladies on bus stops.
Yeah, like, don't take little things for granted like that. Because someone being willing to paint this means that, like, there's importance and purpose in little things. Like, you know, when, like, your dog is being cute, or, like, when, like, your baby takes their first steps, or, like, a great lunch with a colleague. Like, simple things that don't seem like they matter so much, and they seem really small with everything else going on, but you put them in a painting, or you think of them, and you choose to make them important, and they mean so much more, and they transcend everything. Ooh,
choose to make them important.
Bars.
Bars. Gas.
So, I think we summed it up pretty good.
I think we did.
This painting is a precedent for a beautiful attitude towards life.
I bet the peasants hated it.
Yeah.
I bet they saw this and they they gave it the bird.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of art.
That's the beauty of art, baby. So, in conclusion.
Focus on the little moments in life. Be it playing Pop Tropica with your kids, or when you used to play Pop Tropica, or just these finding little educational moments, even if they seem silly or for kids.
Especially compared to like all the AAA games going on.
Yeah.
They're important. There's a reason to remember them. There's little
stuff out there. Yeah. They can bring you lots of joy.
Totally.
Like blowing bubbles.
Like blowing bubbles.
Go home and blow bubbles.
Yeah.
Bye.